We talked about Bitcoin this week, police body cameras, and honeybees as well. So as we do every Friday, let's kick back, let's relax, and head into the break room.
Action continues, of course, and Michael Phelps continues his terrific form at the Rio Games. He clinched his 21st gold medal now.
We've been recommending flossing in dentistry for 150 years, and it's one of those things, there are lots of studies about it, but the problem is all the studies are old.
America has just gotten its very first pizza ATM. Students at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio, will be among the first Americans to access a machine that will somehow manage to make instant pizza.
Joining us in the break room, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, also Hector Fernandez, a professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. And here with us in Atlanta for once is writer and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's
morning.
Good to see you in up north there, Jessica. Normally, if we wanted to see you live, it'd have to be over something like Facebook Live. You like this transition? The latest feature on Facebook made headlines this week. A 23-year-old woman live streamed a standoff she was in with police earlier this month. Facebook shut down the stream at the request of police. The woman was later shot and killed after reportedly aiming a gun at the officers. The social media site also deactivated her account at the request of law enforcement. So here we have a situation which could not have been predicted, say, 20, 30 years ago, right? And I'm wondering how we feel about the way Facebook and, frankly, other social media sites might deal with these situations. Requests from law enforcement to shut down or close an account. Kathy?
I can understand that police don't want their operations interrupted in the middle of an operation, but I still have a problem with Facebook closing down. And it's not just this account. It's many accounts of people who were live streaming video even after the events were over. So I think there might be a little bit of a credibility problem, maybe not in this case, but we don't know what happened.
Right.
For sure. And my other question is, where are the body cameras that the police were supposed to be wearing? Or were they not?
That's another question as well, which has not really been answered. Anybody else want to tackle this one?
I agree with what she's saying. You know, Facebook and these social media sites have the right to do whatever they want as a private entity. But, I mean, the comments, the desire of law enforcement for no reason other than, I mean, they had no public safety interest to turn it off. There weren't people out there rushing to the scene. They didn't even know where
she was in her apartment.
Right. So yeah. I have a problem with that.
Totally in agreement. But and I'll add a finer point. I think when we see these sort of things happening in the Middle East during uprisings and we see, you know, Twitter accounts being canceled or...
It's happening in Turkey right now.
Yes, yeah. Access to the internet being, relegated by the local government. We call it tyranny. And here, I think we should call it the exact same thing. And I think the other issue, I took issue with it beyond Facebook just in making this decision, is that I believe the police have other ways to cut out telecommunications if they want to. If they want to jam a signal or cut off power, do other things that would stop her from live streaming without necessarily impinging upon her First Amendment right, then I think that those things are also available.
Hector?
Gee, I don't know. I think it's really hard to generalize in this case. I understand, you know, freedom of expression and everything, but I, for the sake of trying to be fair to each and every situation, I think it should be dealt on a case-to-case basis.
Okay, well then, case-to-case basis, let's talk about a case of pizza. I guess there are some people who just want to move from something a little bit more serious into something totally not serious. And that is when you really cannot wait for your pizza.
The tab's 13.
You're 2 minutes late, dude.
Ah, come on. I couldn't find a place.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza.
Those are the mutant teenage ninja turtles, but Xavier University in Ohio has made it a little easier for students to get pizza. Later this month, the school will become home to the nation's first pizza ATM, and it is exactly what it sounds like. The $55,000 machine operates 24/7. It cooks a 12-inch pizza on demand in 3 minutes. Okay, so the first question, of course, is would you buy pizza from this machine? The other one is what kind of hot food would you want to make a machine for, right? I mean, if you could have a machine that vended Chipotle, would you do it? Okay, let me start on the other end of the table. Hector?
I don't know. I would go for something Asian. I know it's not ideal for an ATM. The pizza, it just depends how they make it. I mean, if the pizza comes from a brick oven that burns wood, hey, great. But if it's going to be something,
I feel like they're not going to be able to fit a brick oven
to just feed the pizzas, you know, and then you burn them or something. I don't know. I mean, they always find a way.
Okay. Howard, would you eat this pizza?
Pizza, yes. I don't know if there's other foods that I would trust in it through this same process, but I think this is smart on behalf of the college. They're taking some of this money out of the pockets of, you know, the pizza barons out there and making the money for themselves.
Jessica?
I think it depends on what time of day it is, whether or not you're going to eat the pizza and how hungry you are.
True enough.
But I agree. There's not every type of food can just come out of a vending machine pre-cooked. And
so you don't have a particular kind of food you would want to get out of a vending machine?
I love the cupcake vending machines. That's okay. But,
yeah.
You know.
Those seem to be pre-made. I don't think they're baking them in there.
No, exactly.
What about you, Kathy?
So this technology has apparently existed in Europe for over a decade.
Yeah, they had it in Italy for quite some time.
Right. And other, I think in France. But the thing is that I don't think it would be that, I would try it. I don't think it would be that bad, especially up, you know, as a reporter 24/7 if you're starving.
Oh, yeah, we've eaten some bad food.
Yeah, I've eaten some things out of machines that I would not want to have again. But I would actually like frozen yogurt or ice cream to be dispensed from a machine 24 hours.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Right, and, you know, all
like
the toppings.
Scooped. Yeah, there
yeah.
you go.
There you go.
All right, well, then let me put that out to the listeners. A, would you eat pizza out of an ATM machine? And B, what kind of food would you want to be put into a vending machine? You can reach us at OST Talk on Twitter or go on Facebook. And speaking of healthy eating, the Associated Press reported last week, there's actually no evidence that flossing has any medical benefits. Furthermore, the latest federal dietary guidelines for 2016 does not include flossing. So here's Atlanta dentist Alex Rodriguez speaking to Fox. He says, in fact, there's little hard science to prove that flossing works, but he doesn't want people to stop doing it.
Everybody kind of knows you can't let that just gunk build up in between your teeth. I mean, the amount of bacteria that is living on that plaque and stuff in your teeth, if you could see it under a microscope, you'd be disgusted. It's gross. You've got to get that off.
All right, tell the truth here, you four. Do you floss?
Yes, I do.
Yes, religiously.
With those piddly little floss
You say a
sticks.
Prayer while you're flossing?
Well, it's as close as it comes to being religious, at least for me.
I had a dentist tell a friend of mine, only floss the ones you want to keep.
Yes, does it sway you at all that there's no scientific evidence that it actually
helps?
Doesn't
matter.
You?
Your mouth is one dirty place. I mean, it is.
But we don't know if flossing is making it cleaner.
Doesn't
it seems
matter.
Like
Anything
it
helps. Anything helps.
It yeah. feels like it does.
It feels like
And that's
it does.
Enough for you.
It is.
Howard, do you floss?
I do, but I use those little floss sticks
little
sticks. More than I actually use dental floss, I'm ashamed to
it's
say.
It's still floss.
Yeah. Well, then yes. Check the box.
It's still floss. It's still flossing. Does anyone floss more than once a day?
No.
Once annoying
anyone who
enough.
Tells you they do, they're lying.
Yeah.
That's not true because I keep it in my purse in case something gets stuck in my teeth.
Okay.
Then
yeah.
I always have
That's
it
like
with
spot
me.
Flossing, though. It's a little different. Like, I just need to get this one little thing and then I'm back to it.
Right. Well, but it still counts, right?
Well, okay, some people do that. Yeah.
Why? We have a couple minutes left here, and I want to get to the bottom of why you don't care that there's no scientific evidence.
Because it's like every other medical thing where there's an opinion on both sides, and it's just about what works for you. There's people who never floss and have beautiful teeth and.
Really?
I mean.
I haven't seen many of those.
I think that they didn't do the studies properly, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't work.
You don't trust the science.
Or the approach to the science.
The approach to the science,
yeah.
Right.
I could see that.
Okay. All right. Well, again, we'll have to put this out to our listeners. Listen, tell the truth. We know that everybody doesn't floss every day. So if all of you come back saying you floss every day, I'm going to know to be skeptical, not just to the science, but of you. So let us know if you floss and whether it matters that science tells us it doesn't count or work at OST Talk or find us on Facebook. My guests right now are former NPR correspondent Kathy Lord, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. It is Friday. We are in the break room, and we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters, as always. They donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests, and you can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, so Moraine Valley Community College in Illinois recently announced it will offer certain classes only to African-American students. School officials say those classes can be effective because students will build support networks by taking the course with those who have perhaps a more similar background. They're saying that this is part of an effort to get people to finish college. There's a certain number of students that drop out. We talked about that on this show. So what do we think about this? Can segregating classes or creating classes only for one type of demographic, can that help or hurt students? And I got to go with you, Hector, because you're our professor.
Actually, it's both. I'll give you an example. Women's college. Academically speaking, research shows that women perform better academically when they're not surrounded by men. But then again, what that means in terms of exposure to diversity, real-life working conditions, not to mention socializing with the opposite sex, that has also, you know, other implications. So it's both. It's good and bad.
Yeah, I have to chime in here. I went to an all-male college. It also happened to be a historically black at Morehouse College. It was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And I think there are some good intentions wrapped up in here somewhere, but I don't think that this execution is what I would recommend. My concern is the stigma that comes to be a part of this. And I think finding ways to build support systems can be done in and outside the classroom without limiting who can take the classes. So if it's, you know, putting together study groups or getting people to socialize around being prepared to finish school, which I've seen schools like mine do. I think we have an average graduation timeline or duration of 5 years, and the school has tried to make efforts to address that. I think there are ways to do that without saying you can go to this class and you can't.
So we do have an update. Apparently, Marin Community College is not going to do the segregated classes because there was such a strong backlash. But it still leaves the question of, can segregated classes, what if it was a class only for immigrant students?
See, I have a problem with it from the standpoint that these are public. Morehouse is a private school.
It is.
Using tax dollars or public funds and having classes only be available for a certain type of person bothers me. The other problem I have is the class that they were sectioning off was on diversity. So, I mean, I have a huge problem with that.
Courses should be open to anyone. I think students self-select anyway. They'll take what they want to take. I mean, some of this were required sections, but I mean, you can't. You're going to run five sections and say you can't attend the 8:30, 8:40, and 9:40 courses. You can only take it later in the day because you're not a woman or you're not an African American or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, the thing that occurred to me is like, even if somebody has the exact same racial background that I do, I could not be more different than somebody who grew up in, say, rural Oklahoma.
Right.
Going by my race is not going to mean that I have some similar background. I'm not saying that there's not something to be said for creating a community of people with similar experiences, but I'm not sure that you can do that just based on...
I agree. I think Kathy made the point I wanted to make, which is that students will self-select and they'll do this on their own, but having the school or, you know, administrators, teachers suggest it is also a much easier approach to this.
Okay, so let's move to the grocery store where you have to segregate stuff. it could be that in the months ahead, look, I got to transition somehow, right? you might be seeing more quote-unquote ugly fruits and vegetables at the grocery in the months ahead.
Come along, Dorothy. You don't want any of those apples.
Are you hitting my apples on what they ought to be?
Oh, no. It's just that she doesn't like little green worms.
Okay. Nobody's suggesting they're going to sell fruit with worms in it, but stores are now responding to complaints from activists who say a lot of good food is wasted just because it doesn't look perfect. So here's the question. If you find an apple with a small bruise or a scratch or a zucchini that has a flaw, zucchinis get scratched really easily, do you put it back? Or do you buy ugly food? Will you buy ugly food?
Absolutely. I think it's a great idea. I did some stories on food banks years ago that were accepting all of this food. A lot of stores were actually giving them imperfect fruits and vegetables to give to people who were hungry. And I think it's a great idea. And there was plenty left over. So I think it's a great idea. I think they're sold at a discount, these fruits and vegetables.
Often.
In many cases. Yeah. So why not?
I don't have a problem with it. I don't buy it to look pretty on my counter. I buy it to eat it. So I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, and a lot of the food is just going in a recipe anyway, right?
Right.
Hector?
Sure. I don't expect my food to be perfect. I mean, I grew up in the tropics, so I'm quite used to fruits and vegetables with blemishes or marks or whatever. I think it's a great idea.
I have never seen any of you in a supermarket. Like, I go to the supermarket and I pick the food that looks good, right? And I would also say, I think this is a great idea, but I don't think it solves a problem necessarily. I don't think there are enough of these activists to go buy all the bruised and ugly fruit. And so it's just going to be sitting there in the bottom of the bin.
So Howard,
so you don't think people are going to buy it even though it's at a discount?
So the discounted part is new, and I didn't realize that, and I think that might help. But beyond that, I think, yeah, people will pick through it as we currently do, and the ugly stuff will be at the bottom of the bin, and they'll be giving it to the Atlanta Community Food Bank.
I feel like if you grow any of your own things, then you are more forgiving of flaws in your fruits and vegetables. Because I go out,
grow it right.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I go out and look at my tomato plants, and you know they're not always perfectly round and bright red. But they taste delicious. So anyway, we would love to hear from you. Would you buy ugly fruit? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guests in the break room today, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, blogger Jessica Szilagyi, and former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. Okay, let's talk about women's bodies. A new study from the College of Worcester in Ohio suggests women are actually becoming more accepting of their bodies. There's a lot of qualifications. Women are still much less accepting of their bodies than men are. And the study has found, however, even though women are not fully accepting of their bodies, the study found that that dissatisfaction has decreased over the past 3 decades. So, is this a good or bad thing? And I ask that because we do, of course, in the United States have an epidemic of obesity, which is causing all kinds of related medical problems. And some people say maybe you shouldn't be accepting of your body if you are overweight. What do we think?
I mean, we all know that women are the harshest critics of themselves and the harshest critics of other women. So I think that while the dissatisfaction acceptance might be a little more prominent just because of all the campaigns with like Dove and things we see in magazines, I don't buy it.
You don't buy that women are accepting of their own bodies?
I don't.
I think there's a long way to go. As the other woman here, I will speak up. I mean, there are...
Howard and Hector are like, I'm not saying
that. Yeah, right. There are a lot of different spokespeople out. There are models that are, you know, the larger size 14 models, Ashley Graham...
But they're getting a lot of pushback for featuring these larger size models, like size 12 models.
Or on, 14.
Yeah.
And Cheryl Teagues just came out, criticized Ashley Graham, who's a size 14 model, saying she was unhealthy and shouldn't be accepting. And then Graham lost weight, and then they said she was selling out. Now she was too thin. So I don't know about this acceptance.
All this stuff is really complicated. What I will say...
good answer.
Great. What I will say, while trying not to step on a landmine, I think social media, Instagram, you know, all these picture-sharing apps have done a lot. I see people, women, men, whomever, posting these photos with these hashtags and these captions that are so celebratory of themselves and the things that they're doing. And I think so much of this has to be driven by some of that.
Well, I will say that medical studies show that being hateful of your own body, hating your own body, actually it contributes to weight gain and does not help you with weight loss. Okay, so let's move on to the Olympic Games. None of those athletes have any problem with that. The world has paid pretty close attention to the ongoing Summer Olympics in Rio. The game has already witnessed a number of milestones. The Olympics welcomed its first ever refugee team. They were greeted with a standing ovation.
Such love and admiration for these athletes. There are 10 of them, 5 from South Sudan, 2 from Syria, 2 from the Democratic Republic of Congo, 1 from Ethiopia. They are marching tonight behind the Olympic flag.
And then last night, American swimmer Michael Phelps won his 22nd gold medal.
This isn't even close. Michael Phelps is swimming away from everybody. He's got a full body length lead. Lochte is just fighting for a silver. Aguino should get the silver, and Michael Phelps has done it again.
Phelps broke a 2,000-year record. It's been 20 years since the Summer Olympics. We also got our first gold medal for an African-American woman in swimming. There's been a number of milestones here. Okay, so I got to start with you, Kathy, because you told us before the mics went on that you're sleep-deprived because you've been watching too much of the Olympics. Why are you hooked?
It's true. Part of it might go back to covering the Olympics 20 years ago in Atlanta. So I think I fell in love with it probably more then. But it's despite the commercialism, which of course we have, I really love seeing these athletes compete that especially you hear their stories and how they've made it this far. And it's a determination. It shows their lifelong passions. And I think it's a good example for young people and everybody.
And the tiny country of Fiji got its first medal ever, and it was a gold. But Hector, let's go to you, because you very loudly said you are not watching.
Yeah, I don't like the coverage. I think it's poor coverage. It's basically a nationalist festivity. It's a celebration. I mean, if the U.S. had a World Cup habit, then, you know, perhaps there would be a substitute. But in the U.S., it's the Olympics. And, I mean, it can't be that, you know, the only good stories are the U.S. stories. In the end, you look at the coverage and the amount of time that they award to the rest of the world, it's minimal. So it's sort of isolationist. And for that reason, I don't like it very much.
But if you're watching in France, don't they feature the French athletes?
Could be. I don't know. I mean, because they don't have a network, at least awarding so much attention and resources to the overall coverage. If you look at channels throughout the world, I mean, the Americans spend far more money into media coverage of the Olympics than pretty much any other country.
Yeah, Hector's comments made me think, and I think in preparing an answer for this, I'm shifting a little bit. I mean, I was probably for the first time in my adult life really excited about the run-up to the Olympics. First, partly because I was, you know, dejected about how this all came together, how much money Rio was investing, right, and how badly that investment seemed to be shaken out. And then you started to hear some of these great stories, and as Kathy mentioned, all these stories of perseverance. But what I did mention, and I think I might have emailed this, we only hear these stories about the American athletes. We don't hear the perseverance of, you know, the folks from the refugee team or from other countries that I'm sure people have worked just as hard and fought just as much.
Well, we are hearing, to be fair, we are hearing some of them. And in fact, on NPR this morning, there was a major example of a man who, and I think from an African country, who was living on the ground in the streets and
ultimately. We're talking television. I mean,
but we're hearing it both. And we're hearing some of those stories. Not nearly as many, but they're gearing it toward a U.S. audience.
I mean, the drama and the way they can it. I mean,
yeah, some of the drama is over the top.
It's ridiculous.
I don't know, though. I mean, I first of all love the break from the presidential election. For that reason alone, like, let it run. But I disagree in the sense that even though we're not hearing the stories, there's a sense of pride in all of these countries for their country. They're athletes, and that's there. Like, we have a unity right now. Other countries are supporting their people, and I think that's just a positive. It's something we don't see year-round or once every 4 years. So,
That is true, and definitely listeners, weigh in and tell us what Olympics coverage you've seen that you really liked. In the meantime, let's talk about helicopter parenting. Everyone knows what helicopter parenting is, right? Overprotectiveness. Researchers say that can lead to binge drinking on the part of students. They distinguish between good parents who try to prevent their kids from drinking completely and so-called get real parents who assume kids will drink at some point. That's more of the European model. So do you buy this line of thought? Are children more likely to drink? And I guess that's just sort of included in more likely to cut loose and do irresponsible things when they get on their own, right?
I don't know if
she
can
buy it.
Her
face is so doubtful, listeners.
I don't know if it matters what kind of parents you have. I think when kids get by themselves, they make their own decisions, and many kids drink or party, even though you may not want them to, that first semester, and then you learn. You either learn that you have to study or you don't.
Anybody else?
I agree with that. I mean, there's plenty of helicopter parents who raise children who walk the straight and narrow and wouldn't dare have a drink until they have that sideways turned card. You know, I think
by the driver's license, which is vertical for people under 21.
That's right.
Howard, did you binge drink at Morehouse?
Absolutely not.
I can't believe you asked that question.
When I was at Morehouse, you know, almost 20 years ago, there were no liquor stores for miles around, and we were precluded from having cars. There's no Uber, you know, so it wasn't like it was easy access to get.
Fair point.
From Michigan, and, you know, visiting Ann Arbor, I mean, much different experience.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I tend to agree with the ladies. I don't think that one type of parenting over the other is going to produce one outcome. I do think, you know, looking at how the world has changed and how much children are aware of now via the internet, via television, via their peers, I think it's hard, you know, to completely keep the temptation, the curiosity of some of these
you
things.
You can't protect your kids.
I agree, and I think that helicopter parenting may be more and more difficult, if nothing else.
All right, we'll go to our one professor. What do you think here, Prof?
I think in this particular case, I mean, all you can do as a parent is model behavior. But beyond that, the get real parents, in this particular issue, I think they're a tad of enablers. They're enabling the kids a little bit. I don't see a particular reason. If a kid wants to get, you know, booze, they'll get it on their own in any way. There's no real reason for a parent to be doing that.
Okay, we are out of time for the break room. I want to say thank you to all of my guests, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, and blogger Jessica Szilagyi. That's our show for today. But we always want to hear from you, and let's hear back from this. What would you consider yourself a so-called a good parent protecting your kid, or a get-real parent who assumes they're going to come in contact with all of that stuff? Let us know at 404-500-9457. That's where you leave a message for us. You can also reach us on Twitter. I'm at Celeste Headley, and the show is at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.